So welcome back, everyone. And I'll invite you, if it can work for you, to turn your video on. I'd love to be able to see people as I'm speaking, and then we'll have a good period of discussion as well. So today I want to continue with the theme that I explored last week, which I'm speaking about as doing and not doing in meditation and daily life. And I'm also reflecting a lot on my own personal experience and exploration, because I've been, in a way, exploring this a little more intensively than I had previously, this theme in my own personal practice about the last 2.5 months. And that's actually where my motivation to talk about this and explore it further came from my own personal practice, my own edges of learning, particularly finding ways to have the meditation practice come out of a deep kind of not doing. And so today what I want to do, really based on the guided practice we just did, is to review fairly briefly much of what we explored last time, and go further into talking about the deeper dimensions of not doing, both in daily life and in meditation. Maybe do that for 20 minutes or so, and then have a guided meditation which lets us explore personally some of this deeper territory of not doing. And that'll come right out of the talk, and in a way be oriented by the talk. And we'll do that maybe 20 minutes or so as well, 20 minutes guided meditation. And then my aim is to have something like that same amount of time for us to talk about both what we may have experienced, any questions from the talk, and also reflection on any exploration and reflections that occurred in the last week. How many of you did give some attention to looking at the theme of doing and not doing in meditation and daily life? Yeah, fantastic. So I want to give a fair amount of time for us to reflect on that. So by way of review, and connecting very much with the earlier guided meditation, I had spoken about how we could get the sense from the teachings of the Buddha, we can get the sense that a certain kind of skillful effort and doing is crucial for our practice in coming to greater concentration and stability. We want continually to have the effort to connect with and stay with our primary focus, for many of us, the breath. A lot of effort is required to deepen in concentration. And then we have, in our mindfulness practice, depending on the way we do it, but certainly as guided by Mahasi Sayadaw, we have the continual effort to be aware of what's happening, to know what's going on. And many of us may use the labels, or have used the labels at some point in our practice, the labeling of experience. Oh, there's planning. Oh, there's remembering. Oh, there's anger. Oh, there's joy. Oh, there's sadness. And that is a very crucial dimension of our doing, of our wise effort. Obviously, wise effort is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's given a whole factor of practice in itself, really testifying to its importance. And for many of us, the sense of skillful doing may be brought into daily life. Can I be more present when I take the walk, when I take a walk, when I wash the dishes, when I listen to my friend, and so forth, when I do a certain kind of work. And so that quality of doing is very, very central. And for some of us, it's not always easy. It may not be easy to, quote, do one's practice every day, or we may get easily spaced out in our times of practice or consumed by thoughts. So doing an effort is vital. And I know for me, it was probably at the center of my practice for quite a number of years, my first years of practice. And then there's also this dimension, we might say, of non-doing. We brought that out in the guided meditation, particularly by pointing to the importance of receptivity in our mindfulness practice, of simply being with, let's say, pleasant or unpleasant body sensations, really sitting back in a sense and letting them be present, not trying to manipulate them, being receptive, being open to whatever is happening. We do that, so to speak, also. We have that quality of receptivity often when we're with emotions, when emotions are predominant. Can I just be with the sadness? Can I be with my anger? I was thinking of the retreat that I did, as many of you know, right after my mom died. Many of you knew my mom. She used to come sometimes to Marin Sangha. And after she died, I had, it was unexpected in terms of the timing. And I had a month-long retreat, which was very much a grief retreat. And a lot of my role was to just let the grief be there, be present. And as probably many or most of us know, or maybe all of us know, that being receptive to that grief, it comes, it goes, it comes like waves. Sometimes it's there. And without the receptivity, the process doesn't occur in a way that lets the grief take its course. And so that receptivity is very, very crucial. And I also invited us to do some inquiry into the way that we may have a sense of identity as a doer, D-O-E-R, as a doer. And to look into that, I certainly have had that identity. And I mentioned that one of the challenges that I worked with in my own retreat in February was finding that I had almost like a limiting belief that I need to be doing something every moment in meditation, or I won't progress. Right? And could I open to a more radical non-doing? And I'll explore that kind of non-doing in its deeper manifestations in a few moments. But we can really look into our identity of a doer, which again, we can see in many, many ways. We can see that doing, that sense of needing to be a doer manifest when we're maybe in a time when we're not doing so much, maybe for some of us a weekend, or when there's nothing on the agenda, or some of us at retirement and or on vacation. These times, sometimes the sense of a doer as this strong, fairly unconscious identity will surface. And it's very, very interesting. And I was also reflecting on how a lot of this conditioning around doing and not doing is also quite gendered, as many, maybe some of us have reflected, that if you just think of several, I can think immediately of several dimensions of that, when we think of what we call work, and some kinds of doing are called work and sometimes are not. Some types are not. Maybe housework, taking care of children, historically defined as the work of women, is not really called work, as we know. And there are plenty of issues related to that, or the way that professions requiring a lot of receptivity, like psychotherapy, for example, are professions in which I think now it is 75% of therapists are women. Because, so there's interesting parallels there. So I'm not going to go so much into this. We can go further into it, but it just, I was reflecting that a lot of the conditioning around doing and not doing is gendered. And we could probably go into multiple other dimensions of conditioning, maybe around age and so forth. But I just wanted to name that. And so what are some of the ways that this non-doing can be deeper? And I mentioned last time that I wanted to refer to approaches and traditions where there's a kind of what we might call a doing that comes out of a deep non-doing. Action that comes out of non-action. Paradoxical in a certain way, the way I express it, but it actually has an experiential meaning. And I wanted to talk about this in two different domains. Last time, I think I brought up particularly Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, and also gave some readings from the Buddha and from Tibetan tradition to bring this out. But I wanted to bring in a little more fully something I was talking about earlier before we started with Bill, that for many of us may know some of the literature, which I've sometimes talked about. I think I've talked about with you the literature on the notion of flow and the flow experience. And we could say that this flow experience, as it was identified by the Hungarian psychologist named Csikszentmihalyi. We'll give Donna to the person who can spell that in the chat. Okay, no. Okay, anyway. But you look up, it begins with CZ, hint. Okay. Anyway, he identified this experience of flow, which is something I believe that we experience quite often, where we're fully immersed in an activity. We have complete focus, full involvement. There often is a sense of joy and enjoyment. And there is kind of a complete absorption, often a sense of timelessness, or not a conscious sense of time. And this can occur, when we're in the wilds, when we're with people we care for and love, where there's nothing on our mind. And some of the clearest manifestations of it occur in activities like art, music, creativity, sports, actually. And sports, being with the flow experience, is called being in the zone. Maybe many of you know this. I have a friend named Andy Cooper who wrote a whole book called Playing in the Zone, about related to sports. A wonderful book. And so I think I'll read one passage from this. This is from a golfer named Tony Jacklin. He said, "When I'm in this state, this cocoon of concentration, I'm living fully in the present, not moving out of it. I'm aware of every inch of my swing. I'm absolutely engaged, involved in what I'm doing at that particular moment. That's the important thing. That's the difficult state to arrive at. It comes and goes, and the pure fact that you go out on the first tee of a tournament and say, 'I must concentrate today,' is no good. It won't work. It has to already be there." And so you can see that there's, even in his language, there almost, it sounds like concentrates initially, but then he goes into this state where there's not so much of a emphasis on doing, but there's this full immersion. How many of us can relate to those kind of experiences, have had them? And yeah, and maybe we can share some of those later, you know, just what those experiences are like, because I think that those are very common. Partly I'm mentioning this so that we might more easily notice such experiences and appreciate them. And it's a way that there's a deep connection. This is from John Coltrane, the jazz musician. All a musician can do is to get closer to the sources of nature and so feel that one is in communion with the natural laws. I think that's not using the language of flow, but I think that's pointing to something very, very similar. And then we have something which I think is analogous, which is more identified in spiritual traditions, which is a sense that one has to let go of all doing to get to the deeper places. And as in Buddhist practice, this isn't saying at all that doing is worthless. And it's almost like, as we'll experience in a moment in a guided meditation, the doing, skillful doing, opens up the territory of skillful non-doing. One way to say it. And so I think we find these in different traditions. I looked around a few different places, and I think we find this sometimes in the theistic traditions, when it's said that one has to let go of all effort and, as it were, be guided by God, or let the energy of God be behind one's doing, so to speak. So Jesus often says, I do nothing of myself. I think the Taoist tradition may be the clearest expression of this non-doing. And I mentioned, I think last time, that this is understood in the Taoist tradition, particularly the work of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, as Wu Wei, W-U, usually spelled W-U hyphen W-E-I. And this is often translated as non-action or non-exertion. And so it's, passages from Chuang Tzu. The non-action of the wise person is not inaction. It is not studied. It is not shaken by anything. So it's pointing to a kind of non-doing, non-action, that's actually at a quite deep place. And often in these texts, one finds that non-doing at this deeper place actually identified with the nature of being. In other words, one, as one goes further into the deeper and skillful non-doing, one is giving up more and more of that sense of self and coming into, we might say, one's true nature. One's coming into a sense almost of pure being. And you find this in Chuang Tzu very clearly. He says, joy does all things without concern, for emptiness, stillness, tranquility, tastelessness, silence, and non-action are the root of all things. And there's a very interesting text from Chuang Tzu, which I wanted to read as well. It's called When Knowledge Went North. I'll read a part of it where knowledge wanders north and encounters non-doing. which is really non-action. So this is a dialogue between knowledge and non-doing. Ready? Okay. Knowledge wandered north, looking for Tao, over the dark sea, and up the invisible mountain. There on the mountain, knowledge met non-doing, the speechless one. By the way, I'm not going to explain this, so just listen. Okay. There on the mountain, knowledge met non-doing, the speechless one. Knowledge inquired, "Please inform me, by what system of thought and what technique of meditation I can apprehend the Tao? By what renunciation or what solitary retirement may I rest in the Tao? Where must I start? What road must I follow to reach the Tao?" So actually, I will say something. So what's knowledge is asking basically, what should I do? Knowledge is asking non-doing, what should I do? And what's non-doing going to say? Well, if non-doing would speak, non-doing would say, don't do anything. But knowledge, non-doing goes further. Such were the three questions of knowledge. Non-doing, the speechless one, made no reply. Not only that, non-doing did not even know how to reply. The end. Okay, so, but I think you got it, right? I think it's actually pretty simple that here was knowledge, in a sense, in quest to further knowledge, and wanted to be told, how do I meditate? How do I do spiritual practice so I can get to the deepest place? And non-doing was basically implicitly saying, don't do anything. And if we were being more refined, we would say, well, there's some things you can do at first, but at a certain point, don't do anything, right? Something like that. And I'll read one or two more passages, then we'll do our guided meditation. I was thinking of someone who I studied with in the Tibetan tradition named Mingyur Rinpoche. And some of you, how many of you have looked at his book called In Love with the World? It's a very interesting book. Yeah, and he basically starting, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, wanted to do a traditional retreat, but he didn't want to do any formal meditation per se. He wanted to wander around, be away from all familiar circumstances, and in a sense, do nothing. He didn't want to do a long retreat at a retreat center. And so he wandered around, and I actually did a month-long retreat with him just a little while before he went on this retreat. And I was having lunch with him one day, and I just asked him, what are you gonna do on your retreat? I think I probably asked him, what are you gonna do? And his answer was, get lost. He didn't say that to me in the, American slang, Donald, get lost. He said, I'm gonna get lost. And he wanted to get lost and I think go into a radical kind of non-doing. And if you read his book, it's very interesting because it was definitely not always easy. Sometimes it was precarious. At one point, he nearly died. He wandered around India and he didn't even tell people close to him initially where he was, right? He wanted to get out of, kind of the privileged life of being a Tibetan teacher and just actually find ways that the depth of the practice could come out of a kind of non-doing. Interesting story. And maybe one or two more passages to bring this out. These are from the great teacher Long Chenpa. If you meditate again and again, you will see that there is nothing to cultivate in meditation. Nothing to cultivate in meditation. This is the meditation of omnipresent awareness. Another text, freedom is not due to effort. Rather, one abides timelessly in freedom. And I probably would give a gloss on that and say, freedom is not ultimately due to effort, but skillful effort plays a role. But the text is more radical. It's saying freedom is not due to effort. Rather, one abides timelessly in freedom, because in this tradition, as in, you know, as in the teachings of the Buddha, freedom is understood as equivalent to nibbana, which in a sense is outside of the causal realm. It's outside of the realm where one does something and then there are consequences. In other words, the deeper quality of liberation, nibbana, deep awareness, is not manufactured or produced or caused by what we do. That's getting at, if I would, you know, say, you know, point to an explanation of some kind, that's sort of the way of understanding what the basis is for this deeper non-doing. Okay, so that's my talk. And so let me invite you to set up, and we'll do a fairly, maybe about a 15-minute guided meditation. So if you want to stand up for a moment, make yourself comfortable so you can sit. And, you know, if any moment during the meditation you want to stand up or need to shift, please do so. Okay. So let's begin very much like we began with the earlier guided meditation, just in settling, letting go of thinking, even about this topic, connect with your primary focus. Keep coming back, involves a certain amount of doing. And when you feel a little bit settled, you can also bring in the receptive dimension. Again, we have some quality of doing, maybe in tracking what's happening initially, tracking whether I'm with the primary focus, tracking when my mind wanders, continuing in that way. So continually coming back if the mind wanders. Now, as we continue to sit, see if you can let go of that focus on your primary object. And just be aware of whatever is predominant. Maybe it might be the breath, but maybe it would be a thought or body sensations. So we're letting go progressively now of different aspects of our doing. We can let go of thinking, but here we're letting go of will and choice. We're just present to whatever is predominant. We're still tracking, so there's some doing involved. We're still noticing what happens, but there's no choice as to what happens. So we call this sometimes choiceless awareness. It'd be like we're sitting with a river in front of us. There's been a storm. We're just watching whatever comes down the river. Sometimes there's some leaves, sometimes a small tree limb, maybe something else. Just sitting, noticing whatever is predominant in experience, moment after moment. Being with the flow of experience. And continuing to notice this flow. Now, see if you can let go of conceptualizing what you're experiencing, dropping conceptualization, which is a kind of doing as well. Being with body sensations without conceptualizing, or a sound without conceptualizing. Maybe you're already doing that to some extent. So continue to be with the flow. We're still tracking the flow. We're still noticing what's there. So that's a kind of doing that we're still continuing, but we're letting go now of conceptualizing, being with the flow as much as possible without conceptualizing. So we're still being aware of the flow. We're still noticing what's coming down the river. And that's a kind of doing. But we've let go of many other aspects of doing, of will and choice, conceptualization, as much as that's possible. Now we'll go one step further. And we'll let go even of the noticing or the tracking. We'll stay with awareness, but in a moment I'll ask you to let go even of the tracking of what's occurring, even of the noticing of what's occurring. And I'll do this by clapping. And when I clap, I'll say, let go of all doing in your meditation, but still be aware. So stay with the tracking, the noticing of what's happening, as much as possible, not conceptualizing. And now let go even of the attempt to notice or track. Let go. We're letting go as much as possible into a kind of not doing that still is aware. There's still awareness. We're not aware of anything in particular, but there's awareness. We'll do this one more time. Going back to some degree of noticing and tracking what's happening. And when I clap, let go of the noticing, let go of all doing as much as possible. Let go. We'll do it one last time. So again, come back to some degree of noticing, tracking what's happening. When I clap, again, letting go of all doing, just but still remaining present and aware. Let go. Resting in awareness as much as possible. Open like the sky, pervasive like the earth, unshakable like a mountain. Shining like a flame. Lucid like a crystal. As you rest, perhaps in some degree of touching that non-doing, a deeper non-doing, when you're there, what sense of time is there? Is there a sense of time? What sense of self is there? Is there a sense of self? And not necessarily to try to hang on to this quality of openness and non-doing, Just to be present with whatever's occurring for you now for a minute or two. And then the last minute or two of our sitting together like this, I'll invite you to reflect on what you might have experienced or learned. Invite any questions you might have or anything comes to the surface, something you might like to question or bring up a question or share something. Just sit with what comes to you now in terms of what you may have experienced just now. Thank you. So we have a nice chunk of time now to talk about any aspect of this exploration of doing and not doing, including anything in the talk, some of your explorations in the last week, where you might have explored the nature of the doer in your own experience, anything related to the guided meditation. So I see, Patty has the raised hand, so we can start with you, Patty.
Thank you, Donald. I tried this throughout the week, and just like recently, I can only sort of do the non-doing for a few seconds at a time. I don't think I ever got to a full minute. The habit of naming and the habit of being aware of what I'm aware of is a very long time habit. And when I try to let go, the only time it feels like I'm doing nothing or doing the non-doing is right before I fall asleep. It feels like I'm conscious of when I'm going to sleep, I'm like, oh, this is it. And then I'm asleep at night. But when I try it consciously during the day, during a sit, I'm very conscious of how the habit of naming everything that I'm experiencing is there.
Yeah, great observations. Just a few things, maybe in response. One is that a few seconds of experiencing the non-doing. Very good. And in fact, some of my Tibetan teachers have said, you just start with a few seconds, but if you can go there multiple times in the day, you'll gain more access. So if you can, if you were doing a retreat, a teacher might say, yeah, try to go there 100 times a day. But not doing a retreat, if you go there 5 or 10 times a day for 5 or 10 seconds, the capacity will grow. And so that's one thing. And then, yeah, very interesting to look at certain kinds of ordinary states And when that quality of non-doing surfaces, I think the moment we fall asleep, there has to be some letting go of doing, right? For that to happen. So see if you can bring awareness there. Another time is when we're totally exhausted. Very, very ripe spiritual moment. So we can look to a moment like when there's total exhaustion. So it's almost like your body is saying, I'm not doing anything, right? And then you can also look, what's that like when you're, you know, you just get back from a really, really long day? And then just say, okay, what's going on now? And you may be able to tune into something not so different from what we just explored in the guided meditation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I think Liz is next and then Jerome.
Well, I did it. It was amazing. I was just so aware of the body, which was fine. I wasn't aware of anything else. And then I let go of the body. And it just was spaciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fad word that everybody seems to be using now. I'm sorry to have to use it, but that's what happened. And it was like I didn't have a body. It was just spaciousness, and I became molecules or whatever flittering around in the universe in the sky. But so that was really marvelous. Is this related to jhana and concentration practice?
Mostly not. But,
really?
But mostly not. Let me just say that it sounds like you really opened up to a deep non-doing. So
yes,
wonderful.
I do.
Very much like I was saying with Patty, we do, it's something, be content with it just opening up for a short time.
Oh,
that's how it works generally. And we can go there a number of times. 5-10 seconds is fine. If you keep going there, the capacity will grow and be more accessible and be more stable.
So this is not what happens on a concentration retreat?
Generally, it's different. Yeah. There are dimensions of doing and non-doing in concentration practice. And But the level of effort and focus on an object, really a kind of a doing, okay, is very, very strong. That being said, for the jhana to open up, there has to be a kind of non-doing as well. But
so
I think that would be my interpretation of that, that these are different. And most of the, virtually all the traditions that I know that emphasize this kind of deep radical non-doing separate it from concentration practice.
So does this have a name?
Well, it's called different things in different traditions. It's non-action in the Taoist tradition. In the Tibetan and some other traditions, it's sometimes called interestingly, non-duality, which you can, if you want to misspell that, you can misspell it as non-do, D-O, -ality, which is interesting. But it's usually, so non-duality or...
Dzogchen?
In Dzogchen, it would be called Rigpa, which is sometimes translated as awakened awareness.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So who said one abides timelessly in freedom? Freedom is not due to effort?
That was, I think, a text that I found in
Longchenpa.
It was a 14th century, probably the greatest of the teachers and writers in Tibetan Dzogchen tradition.
So I wish you would do a retreat on this, as I've asked you to do. It would be wonderful.
I do a retreat called Settling, Seeing, and Spacious Awareness, which actually brings together concentration practice. Some of you have done this, brings together concentration practice, with advanced insight practice, with opening to awakened awareness.
And can you do it next week?
Next week. I'm planning to do it in the fall.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Liz. And we have Jerome, please.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Donald, I sent you an email. I don't know if you got it, after the last talk last week. And I asked you if flow was basically neither being patient nor impatient. That if you're in a state of flow, you don't have to worry about whether you're patient or you're not patient because of the state of flow.
That sounds right, Jerome, that, you know, so many of the, I think people mean different things by flow. So I don't know if we could be utterly precise, but generally it's taken to be outside of time.
Right. Yeah. That used to happen to me on the tennis court at times.
Yeah.
And it always happens when I'm coding or, you know, doing some computer science stuff. Because I just lose track of time. I don't think about my bodily sensations at all.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of what needs to be done to solve a problem.
Yeah. So I'm not saying, just to begin, I'm not saying that flow is the same as what we were just talking about with Liz, but it gets one into the territory. And so I think that's what you say is right, and that flow is something that many of us experience when we're doing what we really, really, really know well. And there is, I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but there are studies done by two brothers, Hubert and Stuart Dreyfus. Hubert Dreyfus used to teach at UC Berkeley. And they did studies of people who were so-called experts in all sorts of fields. You know, it could be music or computers or sports or all sorts of areas. And what they found was that when they got to the people who are really expert in a given field, they found that there was full absorption and a kind of timelessness and very often intuitive knowing and, you know, intuitive decision-making in a way. So I think that connects with what you said. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Donald. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Yeah. Any others? Anyone want to, I think I can't see everyone, but raised hand is best. But if you want to, the raised hand function, but if you want to raise your hand, I can see most people. And maybe Bill, if you could go to the second screen, we would see everyone. Anyone want to share, especially share something that you explored during the week? Yeah, did you have something, Barbara?
During the week, it was this meditation. And the word is a concept, and it didn't come when I had it, but it was the only word I can think of was I felt like a pre-child.
Wow.
Like my life had sort of been stripped away. I was back at the beginning. And it was just this very this sense of, oh, yes, this is it.
Very interesting, isn't it? It's taken to some really sort of primal way of being, which could connect with memories of being a child.
But it was, but it wasn't being a child. That was a weird.
Right. Thing. It's, it's, and it's interesting that so many of the wisdom traditions, the teaching is one has to become as like a child, right?
Yeah.
But not a child itself. So one's recovering something, but it's different. You're going back into something, but one does so as an adult with the adult capacities, but some of the qualities that may have been conditioned out of us, at least temporarily. Anyone else? Probably have time for one more if anyone else wanted to share something from your week, please. I think that is...
Me?
Jen, please.
Jen.
Yeah.
Okay. I I was able to get where I wanted to go by relaxing. It was sort of like what Patty was talking about between awake and asleep, but during meditation, just letting go didn't ever feel quite right to me because I just couldn't do it. But relaxing seemed to be the operative word for me.
Great. Yeah, I think what you're pointing to, Jan, is that there are many, many routes into this kind of radical non-doing. And we have to find the one that works for us. You know, my colleague, Diana Winston, wrote a book called The Little Book of Being, in which she has at least 50 or so different access routes into something like this quality of sort of being without doing, we might say. And all one needs is one access route or one way of tuning in that way. And, you know, when I teach that retreat on awakened awareness, I teach 5 or 6 access routes. And you just need one. So, Jan, great to identify relaxation may be your key, and it might be different for another person. So that's also important to this whole territory. And so, Corey, you want to come on now?
Sure. I really appreciated when you said that, and I can't remember exactly what you said, something about when you discover it happening in your day.
Yeah.
I discover it sometimes when I'm doing Qigong. I discover it when I'm doing choiceless awareness, and suddenly things just sort of open up and there's this spaciousness, and it's not that things are arising. It's like all are arising.
Yeah.
I notice it sometimes when I just get out of my way, when I'm not pre-thinking, I'm not worrying about what people think about me. There's not that ego thing going on, and I can get it. And it is like more of a flow, whether it's meetings or whatever. But the funny thing that happened this week when I tried to practice it was that when I set my, it's exactly what your friend said about golfing. When I set my intention and I tried to practice it, I could never access it all week long.
Right. So there's a lot of great stuff there, Corey. Yeah, just, but it's, I think the key is to keep on staying with it. Be content with, you know, accessing it sometimes for 5 seconds and that's it. Not to try to strain to make it stay. That's important. And just find the situations that bring it out. If you stay with it, you know, and stay with it, you know, at least a few times a day for even for a short time, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, the capacity will grow. You'll get more familiar with it. You'll notice it when it's occurring because it will be occurring naturally in daily life, but we just don't quite notice it.